Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a regular series of coronavirus conversations, presented jointly with the Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, taking your questions to the experts. This discussion series is featured on our Facebook page, but we also wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you right here in The World's podcast feed. This week, I spoke with Christy Denkla about grieving and mental health during the pandemic. Denkla is a research associate in the Department of Epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and she's also a clinical psychologist who specializes in grief. So, Christy, I've been thinking about this. It's hard for anybody to not be thinking about, I imagine, grief right now. In the U.S. alone, has suffered the losses of more than 500,000 people due to COVID, which is just hard to believe. And these are losses that in many ways were sudden and unexpected. And that also means that millions of us are grieving right now, often without traditional rituals of gathering together. And so I wanted to just start by asking you, what does this all mean? What has been the impact of this collective moment?
Thank you, Alana. I completely agree that even comprehending what 500,000 deaths in this country alone means, it's nearly impossible. And I think at this point, a year plus into the pandemic, we have all experienced we've all been touched by grief. So we've either all probably lost a family member or a friend to COVID. And if we haven't personally, then we know a friend who has. So collectively, we are experiencing this very much together in this moment. However, we are also doing so when we are all socially isolated and distanced. So, you know, I think a lot about mourning and rituals in grief, especially now that we are deprived of access to those things. So I'll start just by saying I'm trained as a clinical psychologist. So I am not an anthropologist, but I have a deep interest in culture. And I think a lot about what rituals mean in terms of the infrastructure and the support that they provide for psychological well-being. So my comments really come from that perspective. And when I think about collective rituals, I think about sort of a couple things that really are critical factors in supporting psychological well-being. So the first is that they provide an infrastructure to acknowledge the reality of loss and death. Death is very, very, very difficult to comprehend psychologically and to experience and to process the death and the finality of losing a loved one is extremely difficult. And so rituals provide an infrastructure and a platform to acknowledge that reality. And there are very diverse ways that these are done cross-culturally, depending on religious values, depending on cultural values, but they all include and share a recognition of the finality of that death. The second thing is that, in my opinion, these rituals share is an opportunity to collectively gather and mourn. Mm-hmm. So this provides opportunity to not only give support to the bereaved, but also for the bereaved to receive support. And that can be emotional support, but it's also pragmatic and tangible support. Food, meals, household care, handling all of the pragmatic things that come with dealing with the loss of a loved one. And in many cases, communities can step in and provide this support traditionally. The third thing is that they provide a language to sort of, sometimes it's a religious language or a spiritual language, just to process the existential crisis we confront when we face death. And it's, we don't think about it in our daily lives often. And when we are faced with it, sometimes we struggle with a language, and religion and ritual can provide that language. And then the fourth thing is that they provide a source of strength and hope. Humans have lost loved ones as long as we have been human, and we have devised rituals and cultural traditions to process that loss. And engaging in those rituals can provide a source of strength and hope that we too can process this loss, and we can survive it. So those are the things that I think of from a clinical perspective when I reflect on the role of rituals.
So how are you reflecting on the role of rituals now when so many people are disconnected? Are there any practices that around death and dying that adapt well to the current circumstances?
Yeah, it's a great question. I have to say, especially at this point a year or plus into this, I am frankly inspired and completely amazed by the creative ways that we have found to adapt to virtual mourning and grieving. There are installation artists Deborah Furstenberg in DC has installed sort of 500,000 white flags. And this is a participatory ritual so that people can request a flag in mm-hmm. honor of a loved one and can view this flag planted and can visit the ceremonial site virtually. This is just a very beautiful sort of creative adaptation of virtual mourning. I think the bereavement community has really mounted a formidable sort of virtual platform to support people. There's especially sort of in the UK, there's been a Good Grief Festival, which occurred at sort of in November of last year. In the US.
What happened with that?
Oh, with the Good Grief Festival. So it occurred over 2 days, and there was organized by Lucy Selman, was one of the organizers, who's a palliative care researcher at Bristol in the UK. And so it was a collective sort of gathering of artists, bereaved people, performers, poets, writers. And so there was a combination of sort of performance art, of testimony of loss, bereaved people speaking about loss very publicly. And this was all done sort of online. So when I learned of this, I was so inspired by the sort of population sort of level response to support public well-being during a time of grief in a context when we normally don't talk about it.
What happens though when grieving happens in a disconnected way, often in isolation, I don't know how easy it is to tell if how many people are migrating to the digital area, but it's not the same.
No, it's not the same at all. And, you know, I think in the mental health community, there's concern. There's a lot of concern about the impact this is having. Grief alone is very painful, and we are not meant to grieve alone. And we are forced now to grieve alone, oftentimes in isolation. And there's concern. And again, this is happening against a backdrop of compounded stressors. And parts of grieving happen alone, but parts of grieving happen in community. And in the absence of that community, I am concerned how people are coping with this loss right now. Digitally connecting is helpful, but of course it doesn't replace in-person connection.
I want to get to some questions that are coming in, but just one other, I guess two other questions related to that. What is the concern, or what can be the long-term impact of that, the fallout of that? I'll start with that.
So specifically with grief, of course, there's concern in the research community for elevated risk for prolonged grief disorder. So prolonged grief disorder is sort of a specific clinical condition, which has now just been entered into the diagnostic and statistical manual, which means that it's a clinically diagnosable condition. Although of course it's been treated there's a tradition of treating it in psychiatry for decades, but it's a clinically impairing condition that can result when grief, as they say, grief is not resolved, even though I don't particularly like that term because grief is never really resolved. We sort of live with it for a long time after we've lost someone we love. But there's concern that there's some conditions now that sort of are raising the risk for clinically complicated grief. And those conditions are isolation. Those things are the inability to mourn and to grieve, the inability or the truncated access to social support. All these things elevate risk. And then of course, having this happen against a backdrop of financial and economic stressors, again, elevate risk. So we're sort of in a perfect storm, we worry, for downstream clinically impairing conditions.
Are you seeing certain communities be more even directly impacted when we think about the inequities and the way that this pandemic has hit different communities, for example, communities of color.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for asking that. And this is one of the most troubling aspects of the time we're in now for me that I see are two things. One is communities of color have always experienced a disproportionate burden of death of loved ones. This is even pre-pandemic. And what we see from some of the social, from the demography literature is that communities of color, oft-time bereavement occurs at a greater proportion relative to whites. So for example, what I mean by that is that, for example, children are more likely to lose a parent. Parents are more, well, it goes both ways, but children are more likely to lose a parent in communities of color compared to white communities. And this has happened before COVID. Now with COVID, those inequities are exacerbated so that these burdens are being disproportionately placed on communities of color. And what I really worry about is the impact on the most vulnerable among us. So children who lose parents, spouses who lose dependent providers. For children who lose parents during this time, they are left without, and especially communities of color where there's less accumulation of wealth, there's less buffer against the adverse consequences. So I'm particularly worried about those that are most vulnerable among us.
Are you seeing this enter, you know, in the US, we don't, in broad strokes, talk about death as so much. How are you seeing this enter policy conversations and recognizing these needs or gaps? Are you seeing this enter, reforms, or as we look at pandemic relief nationally and at the local level, globally?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a source of optimism for me in that sense, is that because of the mass bereavement we're facing in this country, it's almost impossible not to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so it's a conversation that's being forced into politics. It's a conversation that's being forced collectively upon all of us. And my hope is that there can be a concerted policy response. And that hope is bolstered by a couple efforts for things like Evermore is an advocacy organization that's started in Washington, D.C. and is supporting things like a petition to establish a White House Office of Bereavement Care. And some of the very exciting initiatives that can occur if there's a concerted focus on policy around bereavement care is, for example, transferring survivor Social Security benefits to dependent children and spouses. Right now, there's a very ineffective there are gaps in transferring surviving benefits to dependent children and spouses. And a policy or a concerted office could facilitate and identify how to improve that process. So a second thing is, for example, Evermore has talked about establishing a bereavement bill of rights. And this is a very exciting sort of initiative, is to think about what are the basic human rights for the bereaved. And these can be things like seeing the body. In cases where they're traumatic losses, oftentimes the bereaved have to face the body being treated in a difficult way, put into a body bag, or treated disrespectfully. And that can make grieving and adjustment much more difficult. And so a bill of rights could very much protect the bereaved and possibly prevent downstream adverse mental health conditions.
An office of bereavement.
Yes, White House Office of Bereavement Care.
There's some really good questions coming in, and I want to make sure, and some of the things that we've talked about have been touched on here. This question is from Jai. In some sense, the pandemic is making grief a very private thing that happens in isolation, but we're seeing people make grief very public, sharing it on social media, not just with family and friends, but with total strangers. And so what is your take on this practice of grieving publicly online? Mm-hmm.
You know, it's such a great question. And on some level, we don't know. But my interpretation or my thoughts might be a couple things. One is that people grieve very differently. everyone grieves so differently. Some people grieve very publicly. Some people grieve very privately. And there is sometimes we do a little bit of both at the same time. It's a mixed process. So there's really no one right way to do it. I think about, actually, when I think about this, I think about traditional, I can't remember where, but there are wailers. Have you heard of this? So, some bereavement ceremonies, there are women, or I think it's typically women, who are designated sort of wailers, criers, expressive mourners, and so can set an emotional tone for an expression of despair and loss and grief in a safe setting. So I think about this in terms of public expressions of grief online. What we worry about is what are the boundaries around that, and social media is different than gathering in person, and so we just don't know what the consequences are or what the impact is of doing this in a sort of online virtual format.
This question is from Jackson. It's about stigma. Some people feel a stigma associated with COVID-19. How does that affect the grieving process? Is there a sense of shame or guilt around losing someone to this illness that you've observed?
Yeah, shame and guilt are very, very, very difficult emotions to experience and are very much embedded in loss and grief and trauma. I have seen people write about sort of survivor's guilt, people who themselves were infected initially with COVID and then have some concerns that they transmitted to family members who then passed away. And you know, this is the reality of COVID. This is the reality of a very contagious disease. However, it is a virus. It's a virus that behaves as viruses do. And there is, no purposeful transmission that's possible. And so relieving or addressing, I think the shame and this guilt, sometimes the best ways to process it is to acknowledge it and to express it and to voice it. And then it has the opportunity to sort of undergo some questioning and some cognitive challenging and some reinterpretations so that individuals can feel relieved of this. But it is certainly a feature of a very contagious disease, but is absolutely not a feature of the virus itself.
It's interesting to say, to just acknowledge it, that there's so much power in that. One question that this comes up with, I'm just looking at this question. This is from Lori. Can you comment on how no one is talking about grief that came before COVID? Many of us were dealing with the loss of a parent or loved one when the virus hit, and now we feel strange talking about this type of grief.
I'll say the timing of this, forum for me personally occurs a day after an anniversary for me of my own father's death. So my own father died many years ago when I was young. And so I have very much been very personally and very intimately reflecting on this grief and loss. And, the historical loss doesn't necessarily map on to the current experiences that we are having collectively. And I go back again to this idea that every grief is different and every loss is different. And to some extent, loss never goes away. It's been almost three decades since my own father, died, and I still remember it almost every day and feel the pain, especially around anniversaries. So it brings up a couple of thoughts. One is this, the length of this pandemic has probably mapped on to some historical anniversaries of prior losses. And so people are experiencing resurgences of loss and grief during a time when there is additional loss and grief. So there's this theme of these sort of compounded stressors and compounded losses that can really, really be psychologically burdensome. And the second thing is that, the COVID losses are occurring against average and baseline loss. So COVID losses aren't the only losses we're having now. Just last week, a a woman that I was working with experienced an abrupt turn for the worse in a chronic condition and died. It wasn't a COVID loss, but it was still a death. And the magnitude of sort of processing not only just normal health conditions, losses from, you know, pre-existing conditions versus COVID conditions are different, but are all layered here together. So when we say 500,000 deaths, what we're actually talking about is well over, I don't, 1 million, 2 million deaths occurring on top of accidents, accidental loss, injury loss, health condition loss.
I just want to thank you for sharing your own personal experience with this, and I'm sorry for your loss. And
thank you.
This kind of builds on what you were just saying. This question's from Bryce. And thinking about grief that goes beyond death, can you comment on grieving the loss of our typical lives during this pandemic? Routines, mm-hmm. hobbies, celebrations, you know, important events.
Yeah, there has been so much lost during this time. People haven't seen family members in well over a year now. People have lost jobs, lost livelihoods, lost celebrations, lost opportunities to honor. I have been to a few Zoom weddings, and I have birthdays, holidays. You know, these, again, I think back to this idea of compounded losses. So when we, in the psychology, when we think about risk factors for mental health conditions, we think about compounded stressors, and compounded stressors completely increase risk for psychological mental, you know, symptoms, psychological mental. And those can be a range of things, anxiety, depression, suicidal thoughts, hopelessness, lack of interest in pleasurable activities, apathy, interpersonal conflict. I think this is really the burden on couples, on parents, on children, on families, has been quite remarkable. So relationships are stressed. I think that these compounded stressors are troubling.
This question comes from Phyllis, building on that with just the buildup of a lot of these stressors, also job loss, housing, potentially losses in that regard, with all of those demands as well. What happens when we just run out of that emotional bandwidth to cope with it? And what can be done about that?
We are limited. We have limited resources. There's only so much that we can handle. And loss of financial security, so loss of employment and loss of housing, are two of the most significant and critical stressors for mental health. So what can be done on some level, on a policy level, which I think we're seeing happen now, is to provide stimulus and support so that people keep their jobs and people keep their housing. We have to keep our housing and we have to keep our shelter. These are basic needs. Without these basic needs being met, we are at very high risk for mental health conditions. So stable housing, stable employment can be very, very, very critical protective factors right now. And in terms of if we can talk a bit about, in terms of grief specifically, some of the things that we can do to support ourselves during this time. So we start with the body. We think about physically taking care of ourselves. Self-care right now is so important. So eating as well as we can, exercise. Exercise is so important. Exercise, we know from the research, reduces inflammation, it reduces stress, it improves mental health. So exercise is so important. Eating well, sleep. Sleep is challenging now, but having good sleep is very important. So these are some of our basic body needs that can support us right now. Additional self-care things, especially when it comes to grief and loss, are to engage. There are some very, I'll speak on a personal level. I like to write, so I'm a journaler. So sometimes I sit down and write letters. I write letters to my father. I write mm-hmm. letters to people who have passed, who I miss. So we can find other ways to the expression and acknowledgement of these losses can go a long way towards relief. So writing letters, engaging in rituals in the home in small ways that we can find to acknowledge these losses. Flowers, buying flowers. And there are, people are so creative and there's so many ways to acknowledge losses. Art, drawing, music, singing. These are all explicit acknowledgement of the loss and of stress and of worry can go a long way towards relieving it.
I'm really struck throughout this conversation about the kind of returning to this theme of ritual and how powerful that is in grief and mourning and in that process and figuring that out for each individual as well. What happens, you know, there is something unique to this particular moment and with this pandemic, because for those who especially have lost loved ones due to COVID-19, there's this dynamic of people dying alone and not being connected with their loved ones in the hospitals. What do we lose when we don't have that chance to say goodbye? And are there ways that family members can create meaningful goodbyes in that circumstances? Big question. I also wonder if that's changing with PPE and other things. You know, there's been some voices within the medical community about this shouldn't be happening, this disconnect. But I don't know, as broadly speaking, where that's at.
Yeah, thank you for asking this. It was something that I had hoped to be able to touch on today, because this is, to me, is one of the most tragic aspects of COVID-19 loss, is that a couple of things. One is the course of the illness is so unpredictable. So I think for family members, family members can bring family members to the emergency room, drop them off, receive a call within the next 2 days that the loved one has only a few days left to live, or is on an intubator, or is in isolation, or is in ICU. And this is so hard for family members to process, this precipitous decline. And 2 days ago, they were with the family member and they seemed fine, and now they are in ICU. On top of it all, they cannot go to the hospital and be with a loved one. They cannot say goodbye. They cannot view the body. So when we return to this ritual role of funerals in acknowledging the finality and the reality of death, in many ways, people are robbed of that opportunity now, because they cannot see the body. They cannot hold that loved one's hand. They cannot even begin to process the fact that this person, I'm about to lose this person. And when we think about death and loss, we prepare sometimes ahead of time, and that helps. If we can know what's coming, if we can start to process ahead of time and say goodbye and start to let go, that goes a long way in mourning and grief. And right now, so many people are robbed of that opportunity, of that experience, because they cannot go to the hospital and they cannot see their loved ones. Chaplains in the pastoral community have provided a critical infrastructure in this process to help loved ones connect. So for example, in Boston Medical Center, two pastors have suited up in PPE. They have gone into rooms with iPads and on FaceTime and helped loved ones connect and say goodbye to their family members who cannot be there in person.
This question comes from Emily. There's a lot to that question, a lot to that answer, but in thinking about kind of the digital aspects, this is sort of a related but side question, which has to do with the digital and technology issues of people connecting. And sometimes there's a gap in that. In particular, this question is about access for people who are mentally ill. Are there efforts, or how is the American health system working to address these connections, whether it's for people who are mentally ill, or, you know, people beyond this example, that really powerful example that you gave in one particular setting?
Yeah, you know, there's been a proliferation of telemental health now in COVID. In many ways, it's accelerated infrastructure for telemental health. And even within the mental health community, there's people are thinking we may never actually go back to sort of in-person in some cases. In some cases, telemental health can be, it can work very well. In other cases, it cannot. So I think in one of the cases where we see the limitations of telemental health is for the severely and persistently mentally ill. For so, so some so for some for, so for the more chronic care is not enough. Adolescents, I have read concerning articles about rise in adolescent suicide, adolescent suicidal ideation. I know from friends who are practicing clinicians is that they are having to turn people. They are just flooded with requests for services. The mental health system is frankly completely maxed out now. And so this is a concern.
This question is from Shin. We've seen a lot of discrimination against Asian communities. How do we help these groups cope with this as they also grieve their own losses?
The discrimination and stigma in COVID has been frankly a tragedy. This is a virus, and unfortunately, for in regrettable ways, this has been translated into a source of stigma and discrimination. We are I, it, this there's a gra there's a reawakening of the effects of discrimination on people. And I think there are more and more ways that we can act. And there's a growing awareness that we have responsibility to act. When we see discrimination, we have a responsibility to stop it. And so we carry that responsibility as community members to prevent and to stop and to support those who are experiencing this and to do what we to find a way to attenuate this on this stigma, which is awful.
In processing a lot of what you're saying, I wanted to step back. This question's from Pat. We just have a few minutes left. Thank you for your time. What are your thoughts about the collective social numbness that's come from just the sheer number of people who've died over the past 12 months?
Numbing and dissociation and distancing. This has actually been a particular research interest of mine because in some cases it can be protective. So in some cases, seeking psychological distance or going through some numbing, it helps us get through a difficult event. I think right now what is happening is that we're very much in the middle of this. This is not over. This is still ongoing. And it's very difficult to stop and acknowledge and process when it is still happening. It's almost psychologically impossible to truly process and absorb this without hindsight, without some distance. So I think that the psychological numbing and the distancing right now isn't necessarily maybe I say a bad thing. It can provide a buffer. It can help us get through a very demanding time, and then when we have the space, we might go back and start to process. Now, that isn't to say we should distance and numb ourselves right now, but just to say it isn't necessarily a bad, always a bad thing or precondition for adverse mental health down the line.
This question's from Tommy, have you been surprised, or in what ways have you been surprised by people's resiliency?
This is a nice question, sort of at the end. So thank you for that. What we've learned partly through the scientific community, but also through observation, is that we are surprisingly resilient. It's one of the reasons that I've been personally very interested in bereavement, because it is, in a sense, a normative life event. We have evolved the capacity to adapt to grief. We've evolved the capacity to experience very painful emotion, but to also get move and adapt and integrate it into a new perspective and into a new life. And so what I'm inspired by now is the collective conversation about the importance of grief, about rights of the bereaved, about transforming social policy around loss and support, which can go a long way to reducing inequity. And so I see this as very much an opportunity on a public health level to have some very long overdue conversations, but also to transform policy that can have long-term benefit. And then the third thing is is that I do believe we are deeply resilient, and I do believe that the prevalence of things like prolonged grief disorder, it's not the full population. So everyone who experiences loss is not necessarily, it's not prescription for mental health difficulty. It's painful. We can't experience the pain. We can't survive it. And in some cases, we do sometimes need clinical help. But in other times, for the majority of the population, people will kind of come to an integrated place.
That was Christy Denkla, a research associate in the Department of Epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and a clinical psychologist who specializes in grief. I also want to add that if you or a family member need assistance with a mental health issue, you can call SAMHSA's National Helpline at 1-800-662-4357. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. This Q&A was jointly presented by the Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can find the video of this discussion on our Facebook pages at Forum HSPH and at PRI The World, and see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.